Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hi everyone and welcome. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Tai Singh about that perennial favourite, what makes a good villain, the bad guys in the action movies. Tai is a producer and an author of two books on the subject, Born to be Bad and Born to be Bad Part 2, both books featuring interviews with the bad guys who usually don't get an opportunity to talk and often end up in a hail of bullets. If you like the episode, please remember to like, subscribe. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. John D. DrJonty. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation.
I think can make or break a good action film, and books have already been written about all the heroes. You know everything you need to know about Arnie and Stallone and Bruce Willis, and if you're writing a book, you're going to need access to those stars. And when I started out, I had nowhere near the credentials or kind of the access that would be needed to kind of interview those peoples. But the actors that have played bad guys in a lot of the films I grew up watching from the 80s and 90s, they are a wide mixture of people, from like British stage actors to stuntmen to, in some cases, ice skaters and ballet dancers. They're weightlifters. So they come from a whole range of sectors, and just being able to talk to them was much, much easier than reaching out to Hollywood's A-list stars.
Yeah, and you get that with your interviews. There's a real sense I got from reading. I've only read the second volume of your book, so I'll put my hand up there.
That's fine.
But I got a feeling from the interviews that they were really keen to talk about it. It was a real sort of sense of, oh yeah, nobody usually talks to us, so, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. There is definitely also a lack of a publicist, which, you know, from the news this week with stars like Matt Damon, who are often pulling their hairs out of what their clients say, you know, with these actors who, you know, don't have publicists or a talent agency behind them, they are very forthright about their experiences. And especially in the first book I wrote, people had no problems just shit-talking some of the actors they had to work with. One...
As I haven't read that book, you have to give me the shit-talkiest.
Oh, I mean, this is not going to be a revelation to anyone who vaguely knows anything about him, but Steven Seagal does not come off well from anyone who has kind of worked with him.
Shocker.
Anyone who has worked with Steven Seagal, if you bring up the name, they immediately just kind of, oh, let me tell you about Steven Seagal. And it inevitably ends with, and he's a complete dick.
Right.
So with all the revelations and accusations against Mr. Seagal, I don't think that came as a surprise to anyone.
Wow. Fancy having that reputation as well. But, you know, I mean, because these guys must know they have this reputation. It must come back to them. Or not. Are they just surrounded by a court that you know, shields them from that kind of criticism?
Sure, the bigger stars do, you know, because a lot of the people I've worked with, you know, I've worked with people like Stallone and Arnie, and depending when they worked with these stars in their careers, the stories vary wildly. So I've interviewed people who've known Arnie throughout his entire career, and they have nothing but great things to say about him. I've met people who worked with him in the later stages of his career where he comes over as a bit arrogant. But then likewise, people have said he is a great guy to work with, very friendly. Same thing about Stallone. People say that, you know, he is the hardest working person in the room. He's great. He's a very inspirational figure. But then you talk to people who worked with him when he was at his peak in the 80s, you know, Rambo 2, Rocky 3, and, you know, names were just greenlit on the back of his name. And he doesn't come off well. He's a kind of a peak ego stage. And, you know, if I was Stallone, I would have probably fallen into the same trap. But it's amazing how some of these A-list actors, you know, their self-awareness kind of takes a dip at the peak of their career. And then they kind of realize that in later years and they become a little bit more normal and well-rounded. But hey, it was the 80s. I'm sure everyone was like that to a point.
I heard a brilliant story about Stallone. Basically, a friend of mine was working on at a studio with him, and he was they were walking down the studio backlog talking. And Stallone was kind of talking about something about his modern art collection or something. And he was talking quite seriously about it. And then some sort of teamsters walked by and went, "Oh, hey, Sly." And he sort of turned around and just totally changed demeanor and went, "Hey, how you doing, guys?" And it was just like, whoa, you know, that his persona has this sort of slightly, you know, I'm exaggerating, but a slightly curated edge. What was the first baddie that you kind of, when you were watching movies, even as a kid, you sort of found yourself fascinated by or attracted to or terrified of?
Terrified. I mean, as a child, I was easily terrified.
Right.
Horror films scared me, and it wasn't until I got into my mid-teens where I think the adolescence fear I had of extreme violence and horror just disappeared forever, and then I just dived headfirst into all of that. But I do remember going to a friend's house when I was 12, 13, and he showed me, for the first time, I hadn't seen either of these films before, Commando and Mad Max 2 back-to-back. And Vernon Wells as Bennett in Commando is a villain that you can't take your eyes off because you're like, is he threatening? I don't find him threatening. He's weird. He's psychotic. Yeah. But I don't believe for a chance that Arnie's not going to pummel him. And then in Mad Max 2, you know, the biker gangs and Lord Humongous, you don't see his face. He's just there in a metal hockey mask, just naked, torturing people. And it's kind of like, this is fascinating. I don't know who he is, what's going on, but I'm scared of him and I don't even have to see his face. So it is definitely those kind of villains that got burned into my memory from a early age. And then, of course, being from the UK, Bond villains are a big part of that. But when I first started writing my book, Vernon Wells was at the top of the list for that reason. And
right.
Luckily for me, he was one of the first actors to say yes. So I thought once I had Vernon Wells off the list, then hopefully other doors would open, and they did.
I interviewed Ben Mendelsohn for, what was the film? The King. And I asked him about sort of being cast in villainous roles. And he compared it to just being a taxi driver and you have your patch. And, you know, that if that's your patch, he's perfectly happy to make a living doing his patch and trying to find the interesting angles. It's not, you know, and I thought that was interesting that, you know, the possibility of stereotyping or typecasting is a better phrase. Did you find any of the people you were interviewing sort of resentful of that, or were they mostly just happy to do what they can?
Everyone had a different story. So kind of Paul Freeman, who played Belloc in Raiders of the Lost Ark, In the first book, he was kind of like, yeah, after Raiders of the Lost Ark, I kept getting offered roles to play Nazis. He's like, I wasn't even a Nazi in Raiders of the Lost Ark, but they kept getting offered to me. David Warner, who amazingly, when I first sat out to interview him, he was like, why are you interviewing me? I don't normally play villains. It's like, of course you do. You literally play evil in The Time Bandits, you know, and then just start listing off films like Tron and Titanic. And he was like, oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. And he said after playing Jack the Ripper in Time After Time, there was a phase where he kept getting sent villainous roles. And yeah, actors like Timar, he's been offered a bunch. But I think there are loads of actors that see it as, hey, they're always going to keep working. And even today, people like Mads Mikkelsen, he is offered every villain role under the sun. And he takes them because he knows he can just go back to Denmark and make films like Another Round and Riders of Justice. Whereas here in Hollywood, he can just collect that big Warner Brothers paycheck from taking over from Johnny Depp or being in the new Indiana Jones film and then do whatever he wants in his home country. So I think it all depends on the actor and the opportunity. But, you know, for working actors, very few are going to say no to roles. If you've got the luxury to kind of pick and choose, then I'm sure many will.
I think with Mads, and, you know, I mean, I first saw him in Casino Royale, but then I went back and watched his work in Pusher, particularly Pusher 2. And he's amazing in Pusher 2. He's such a great... And then obviously, you know, he's become widely recognized by everyone, I think. But I think, I mean, is it something almost physical that a certain very distinctive look seems to be important, you know?
I think it all depends really when the film's getting made, because obviously in the 80s you had people like Stallone and Schwarzenegger and they're big muscle bound guys, and you needed people to kind of go up against that type of hero. But then you also had the more sophisticated bad guy like Alan Rickman in Die Hard. So it all depends on the film and who the main actor is, because obviously in the 70s your action heroes were kind of Charles Bronson, Clint Eastwood. So you had people like Andrew Robinson playing the Zodiac killer Scorpio in Dirty Harry, and he's just like
basically the Zodiac killer.
Yeah, he's just a weirdo, and at no point do you think that he's ever a physical threat to someone like Clint Eastwood. And then in the 80s you kind of get big jacked up bad guys who are former weightlifters or stuntmen that can fight people like Arnie and Stallone. And then in the 90s, when action heroes kind of slim down and get more slender and look like Keanu Reeves or Christian Slater or Brandon Lee, you get a different type of bad guy altogether, you know, martial artists or actors with Oscars under their belts suddenly started being offered these villainous roles because it's just more appealing. And after the success of Alan Rickman, it's like, yeah, no, let's get some thespians in here to shake things up. So yeah, it's everyone's different. And I thought that was the great thing about interviewing these actors, because no one really had the same story.
Talking about thespians, even Stephen Berkoff predates Alan Rickman as that kind of 80s bad guy with those, you know, those crazy eyes. I mean, I guess that's what I mean by a sort of physical characteristic. Because
yeah,
the sort of the mad stare, the ability to stare someone off the screen, basically.
It's actually Berkoff's birthday today, I think. Yeah, I interviewed him for the first book, and he was very upfront about how he doesn't like making Hollywood films. And while he was like on the set of Beverly Hills Cop or Octopussy or Rambo 2, he would be just in his trailer writing plays, just kind of going, yeah, I will just get through this testosterone-fueled nightmare, and then I'll just go back to the UK and do my own thing. Because he was, you know, savvy enough to realise that this will open doors. He doesn't necessarily enjoy the experience, but it's an opportunity. And, you know, from making a Rambo, he can fund three of his pet projects.
What about, there's always a line with a lot of these villains. I mean, I was thinking, because I was reading your book, and I tweeted the other day about how, you know, a villain that you don't sort of love to hate in a sort of camp, enjoyable way, but you really do just sort of fearsomely hate. What's one of those villains for you?
There's a villain that I hate because he's a dick. But weirdly, he is also 100% right. And that is William Atherton in Ghostbusters playing Walter Peck. So I interviewed him for the first book. And essentially, he is an obnoxious bureaucrat. He is rude. He's pushy. And when you're watching Ghostbusters, you're like, yeah, Peter Bateman, stick it to this guy. He's a prick. But he is 100% right. He's working for the Environmental Protection Agency. And for all he knows, these con artists are, you know, convincing people they've seen ghosts. They are possibly storing unlicensed chemicals in their basement. And they're walking around with unregulated nuclear reactors on their back. Everything about the Ghostbusters is suspect. And he has every right to be there to demand access to their operations. And everyone is being a dick about it. Bateman's being a dick. Walter Peck's being a dick. But Walter Peck is clearly in the right. And when I interviewed him, I was like, this film came out at the height of the 80s. Do you believe that your portrayal of the EPA has something to do with Donald Trump inherently hating the EPA? And he was like, I think we're just giving Donald Trump a little bit too credit to have learned anything from anything. So I don't think so. But yeah, that is a villain who it's like, he's absolutely loathsome and you want him to get his comeuppance. But he is 100% right in what he's doing.
Such a good point. I always think he's an interesting actor as well because he starred in one of Spielberg's first, I think it was his first cinematic film.
Yeah, the Sugarland Express.
Yeah, with Goldie Hawn. And he's sort of like a lead character. But he's a sort of lead character in that sort of 70s way of being a bit of a loser and a bit of an outsider and not particularly heroic. But it's just funny how his career went from that to playing, as you say, the Peck in Ghostbusters. And doesn't he turn up as an obnoxious FBI agent in Die Hard as well?
He's a reporter. He's Richard Thornburg, who endangers the McClane family by putting them on TV.
And then he's also punched out by the wife.
He does. Bonnie Bedelia smacks him around the face.
Yeah. Oh, man. Not really. I'm hoping it was pretend, but
You'd hope so. I don't know what kind of set John McTiernan runs, but yeah.
I can't help but think, though, it's almost like an atavistic thing that when I see actors in different roles, I just assume it's the same person, if you know what I mean, just the same character as well. So it's like, God, this guy's got some bad luck. Just keeps turning up. What's that? There's a book, is it David Thompson wrote, called 10 Bad Dates with Robert De Niro, which is just which is just a list of, I mean, it's a book of lists, essentially, but one of them is, you know, all the dates that you see Robert De Niro have in movies and how terrible they are. You know, Taxi Driver, it dates Cybill Shepherd to the porn theater. And, you know, so apparently, yeah, De Niro is not, you know, regardless of what Bananarama sang, you know, he's not a good guy to go on a date with. So what about like your, he's one that you sort of hate. What about one that you fear? Because I don't think you'd fear Peck, would you?
No.
Because I remember, it's come up in quite a few podcasts that we've done, quite a few episodes that we've done, but I remember really being absolutely terrified of Darth Vader. I mean, I saw it on the big screen. I was very young. I was like 6 years old, I think. And it just terrified me.
I think as a child of the 80s and 90s, for me, Darth Vader was always there. So I don't have that kind of, who is this man? He's terrifying. It's just Darth Vader, pop culture icon. But the villains that I always found the scariest were the ones that clearly couldn't be reasoned with and didn't have any semblance of humanity. So, you know, someone like Alan Rickman in Die Hard, you're like, oh, he's charming. He doesn't really have to kill people unless he has to, even though he's going to blow up all the hostages in order to get away. You kind of feel that if he likes you, you might, you know, be able to talk your way out of it. But it's the villains who they're like, I think, Scorpio in Dirty Harry, where he's so unhinged. He's slapping children around on a bus. He's just coldly sniping people from rooftops. It's like, there's no way into that character. You're kind of like, you are terrifying. And as a result, actually, the actor Andrew Robinson, casting directors were afraid to meet him as a result. He didn't work for years afterwards because he told me one story of where he was walking up the path to meet a casting director at Warner Brothers, and then they recognized him, and then they canceled the interview and told like their secretary to send him away because they were like that terrified of him after his portrayal in Dirty Harry. So it wasn't until, you know, the odd role in Cobra and Hellraiser and then Deep Space Nine, where he plays Garrick, that, you know, he started working again. But there was a fallow period for him because he was so effective at playing a psychopath.
And these casting directors presumably have worked in Hollywood. They understand what a film is. They understand what the actors are. They understand
Have thought so, but apparently not. No.
That guy, he kidnapped kids in a bus. I'm not talking to that guy.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so funny. That's such a good. Are there any other sort of like real life consequences from, you know, I mean, I remember Mike Baldwin from Coronation Street being in a pub once, which I was in, and somebody went up to him and said, "Mike, I think it's terrible what you're doing to Deirdre." Or has there ever, have you come across situations where people who've played baddies have sort of found themselves being shouted at in restaurants or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Plenty of them have kind of like, "I can't believe you did that thing in the film." And William Atherton said there were years where people just yelled "dickless" at him across the street after Ghostbusters. So many people have stories like this where they're just kind of like, ugh. But if anything, it kind of comes down to a credit to their acting abilities that they managed to get that kind of reaction out of people, where people are coming up to them in the streets going, "I can't believe you did that thing and that thing that I watched. How could you?" And they're like, "I'm just very good at my job."
I bet, but I mean, dickless is it? That's a backhanded compliment if there ever was one.
That just goes to the popularity of that film. I think for him, it was both kind of a victory lap at this, you know, how well Ghostbusters did, and just kind of like, "Oh, I'm gonna have to deal with this one for at least a decade."
I'm with my kids.
I'm with my kids. Guys, I'm on a date. I'm eating out. What are you doing?
Oh, unbelievable. Oh wow. So I mean. One thing you mentioned earlier was, of course, the Bond films, which, you know, being from the UK as well, yeah, hugely influential. And in fact, I heard someone say something a year or so ago, which I thought was very true, which a Bond film is only as good as its villain. You know, The villain has to be top class, which actually has made Casino Royale, I think, better in retrospect, because I remember watching it without really knowing who Mads Mikkelsen was and thinking, yeah, he's okay, and then appreciating him more. And as you do, the sort of the level of the film goes up. Who would be your favorite Bond villain, and who would you, you know, do you think that's true, that you really need a good villain for the Bond film to work?
I do. And the thing about Bond films is you can have multi-tiered villains. Like, you can have someone like Donald Pleasance, who represents kind of the more cerebral villainous side, and then surround him by a big bunch of heavies that, you know, provide the physical threat to Bond. But in terms of like elevating, you know, a Bond film, it's always going to be Christopher Lee as Scaramanga, because on its own, The Man with the Golden Gun isn't the best Bond film. It's ripping off 70s kung fu films. Britt Ekland is wandering around the film, getting in the way. There's knick-knack.
It's like a list of people who you know, would be offended, and kind of rightly so.
The plot, it's about an energy crisis. Like, I think Bond's trying to get like a device that will convert solar power, because, you know, there's the energy crisis going on in the 70s. So plot-wise, it's good to see we haven't moved on in 50 years. But Scaramanga, because Christopher Lee is just so charismatic, and, you know, the scenes where him and Bond are having dinner, and it's been aped so many times by Partridge, by Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon in their trip things. It's like, come, Mr. Bond, we are both killers. And he just elevates the material. And I think that is a prime example of where the villain elevates the entire film.
Yeah, yeah. I rewatched that recently. I think at the beginning of the lockdown, I had a new set of Blu-ray collection of Bond movies. So I watched them from the beginning to the end. And the one thing that drives me nuts about that film is there's an amazing stunt, the corkscrew jump over the river.
They do the slide whistle.
It's just, and the cutaway for comedy reactions as well. And it's just like, that's the best stunt. And you ditch it, you know, it's just awful.
The other one I love, one of my favorite Bond films, is actually The Living Daylights. And that's one where it has a bunch of villains, you know, Joe Don Baker and I've forgotten the actor's name, the one who's in The Fugitive, but he plays the defector, Gorgi. As villains, they are completely ineffectual. And the main threat is Andreas Venusky, who plays Necros, the big blonde KGB henchman who disguises himself as a, you know, throughout the film, and strangles people while listening to The Pretenders. And he's great. I interviewed him in the first book. But that is a film that I think has the most complicated plot of a Bond film. There's defections, and it's so he can like sell weapons to Taliban in order to get opium, which he's then going to sell on the black market. So Bond's got to team up with the Northern Afghan Alliance to stop the Taliban and the Russians. It's so overly complicated, more than a Bond film needs to be. But I love it so much because of the bad guys. I love Timothy Dalton. It feels like a real Cold War thriller. that suddenly ends up in Afghanistan. And it does have that great stunt where they're on the back of the plane, on the cargo net, fighting each other. And yeah, I think Andreas Venusky, on the back of being in a Bond film and also being in Die Hard, where he plays Carl's brother, Tony, who's killed at the beginning, he thought he was going to have a very long career in Hollywood where he would just play big blonde henchmen and Nazis. And that never happened for him. He was just the odd bit part here, you know, showing up in Mission Impossible as Vanessa Redgrave's right-hand man, and then reprising the role weirdly in Ghost Protocol, where he has no lines. It's, yeah, that is an actor where, you know, you've been in two big films, you're like, hello, Hollywood, I am here, and nothing.
Wow, and then there are certain actors who seem to work on five films per year who I'm never quite sure how. I just think, oh, they must have wonderful agents, because I don't see it in the work.
Or it's just contacts, just knowing people and being a very reliable and nice working actor. Vernon Wells from Commando, he makes about five films a year. He works with on lower budget films, but he's just there. He'll come in, do his work for a few days, you know, be a bit of a bolster to a cast for like a young filmmaker who's trying to get a film made. And yeah, he just does his stuff and goes. And people are always like, oh, what happened to that guy from Commando? He's constantly working. And he was in like the Power Rangers, I think. He's like a bad guy in the new generation of Power Rangers. So to a whole generation of kids, I think he's still quite a big deal.
The best advice I ever got as a journalist was someone just said to me, always respect the word count and always respect your deadlines. And you'd be surprised about how many people don't do that. So by just doing that basic thing, you know, you'll put yourself in the lead of quite a few other people don't.
Eric Roberts has 300 IMDb credits, and I'm sure he would be the first to say that 80% aren't that great. But he's constantly working. He will go there, do the job, probably for a day, get his paycheck and go. And say what you want about the films that he makes. People are hiring him for a reason. He's reliable. He'll come and do the job. Whether you like that work or not, Eric Roberts, constantly working.
Danny Trejo as well.
Danny Trejo, another one, yeah.
It's almost a record holder, I think.
Yeah, he'll come in, be Danny Trejo, do the work, and that's it.
Be a lot of fun at lunch. Yeah, that's the important thing. If you're fun
tell
at lunch,
some harrowing stories at lunch. And be great.
I think that's underestimated how much people get hired because they're good at lunches. You know, they're fun to have on the set.
Yeah, I once heard an interview with Danny Trejo where someone was talking to him about Con Air, and they were like, oh, you're on Con Air. That's the most testosterone-packed film, you know, John Malkovich and Nicolas Cage and Ving Rhames. He's like, you've hung around with a lot of badasses. And it's like, who on that set could take care of themselves is like legit the hardest guy. And he was just like John Cusack. It's like people write off John Cusack. John Cusack, 6'4". He's been doing kickboxing since he was a teenager. He doesn't need to show off. He just has that look where it's like, I don't need to preen like some sort of peacock. I can just take care of myself. He's like, don't fuck with John Cusack. John Cusack will mess you up.
Wow.
So it's like, there you go. Star of Say Anything could beat up everyone on the set of Con Air if he wanted to, but he didn't need to.
You've just saved lives, because there are so many people who listen to this podcast who would just brush past John Cusack and maybe knock him into the gutter a little bit as a pasty-faced guy, and then he's going to wipe the floor with them. So
I've interviewed his kickboxing instructor, Benny the Jet Akides. So in Gross Point Blank, the assassin that he fights in the hallway, that is his kickboxing instructor. And Benny the Jet is like an undefeated kickboxing champion. He trained the cast of Street Fighter. He trained the cast of Roadhouse. He's fought with Jackie Chan in Wheels on Meals and Dragon Forever. He's fought great martial artists. And he's like, yeah, no, I trained John Cusack. And for that film, Gross Point Blank, I was just like, I trust you, you trust me, let's just go at it. And they are just pummeling each other in that scene.
Yeah.
So yeah, if anyone comes away from this interview with one piece of advice, it's don't piss off John Cusack.
Absolutely. I remember during the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, right at the beginning of them, he sort of went down there on his bike, and there's a film of him being sort of told to turn around by the police officers and everything. And now that just gives that a whole different fizz. Sort of like, what was Cusack doing? He's taking it into his own hands.
I mean, one can only assume he was there, you know, to take part in the protest. I don't think John Cusack's the type of guy who's going to go down there and start protesting against Black Lives Matter.
Oh, no. He was definitely BLM. He wasn't ALM. Absolutely. But wow. What about when I you've mentioned adolescence earlier on, and I went through an adolescence stage where I would watch movies that I had watched already, usually, and I would just find myself siding with the baddies. I would find myself watching Star Wars and going, come on, fire already, fire, you know, get the... Are there any sort of baddies who you're in danger of being recruited?
I don't think so. That never happened with Star Wars. Right. And it's clearly because they're all space Nazis. And I'm like... As from a very young age, I was like, oh, look, they're all white and British. And look at the Rebels. It's all a bunch of aliens and it's a mixed bag of people. And I was like, oh, I'll hang out with those guys. Never wanted like the Empire to win. I think from a very young age, I was like, there is something not that welcoming about these stormtroopers. They are terrifying. But bad guys, not really. I mean, I always grew up as a big Star Trek fan. And I think watching Star Trek a lot, I was always like, you know who'd be fun to hang out with? Bunch of Klingons. All they want to do is eat, drink, sing, get into brawls. I bet no
have
one parties
harder.
Have a strange
Muppety dark crystal dog like
exactly.
Christopher Lloyd in Star Trek 3.
Christopher Lloyd, yeah, he's just wrestling aliens for fun. I was like, yeah, I don't think there would be anything more fun than partying with a group of Klingons for one night. And then you would regret it for at least a month afterwards. I think they are the only bad guys where I was like, yeah, I'd hang out with them.
Yeah,
I think everyone else is like, no. Something would end up going wrong and I'd inevitably be killed. It's like, who wants to be the random henchman?
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In like a Bond villain lair, it's like you are either going to get killed by James Bond or you're going to be killed by your boss as some sort of example to everyone else. It's like, this is not a safe working environment. I would not do well here.
I wouldn't want to sit on the board. I wouldn't want to sit around that table, that oval table.
I am not going across that very thin bridge that goes over his piranha moat. I'm not. No.
And just for listeners, Ty is drinking from a Star Trek mug, thus proving his point.
I'm a cliche.
Were you original Star Trek? What's your favourite?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Star Trek. When you grew up in the UK in the 90s, Star Trek was always on.
Yeah.
So 60s Star Trek was on Friday nights. Next Gen was on Wednesdays. When Deep Space Nine started, that was Thursdays, and Voyager was on Sundays. So my dad had a lot of 60s Star Trek recorded from when it was on in the 70s after News Round.
Yeah.
So I watched a lot of that. And then I was already a Star Trek fan when Next Gen started in the UK. Just kept on watching.
Yeah. No, I probably saw those ones, the original ones in the 70s. And then I remember Next Gen coming out and there being a big sort of fold out in the Daily Mirror or something, you know, telling you who all and being very suspicious of it, being, not sure about this.
If you can go through all of history and just kind of every time a new Star Trek thing launches and the fans or people going, oh, I don't know about this, a woman captain, a black Vulcan. What is going on? Or it's just on a space station. They don't move. It's never going to work. Oh, God. Every time it happens, every time there's a new Star Trek series, it's like, I can't tell sometimes which fandom is the worst.
I just any fandom that is called a fandom is
any fandom. Star Wars, Batman, James Bond. Every time there's a new casting, it's like, oh, this is going to be the worst Batman ever. I can't believe they cast Heath Ledger as the Joker. It's going to be the worst. What, this actor's blonde? He can't play James Bond. Who is this 6'4" Australian playing Wolverine? It should be Bob Hoskins. It's like throughout history, fandom is consistently wrong. And every time there's a new casting, it's just another wave of they're inevitably going to be wrong in a year, but let them burn their effigies and everything in protest. It's like, it's unbelievable. It's exhausting.
And yet the unearned arrogance remains somehow that they're going to be right about this as well.
This isn't Star Trek. I'll tell you what Star Trek is. It's a Star Trek I have in my... Star Trek suddenly now politically correct. Oh, my God. It wasn't inclusive in my day.
It had the first interracial kiss on American television.
It's exhausting. Fandom. I blame social media. It amplifies the worst possible voices in every possible fandom. And you're like, does no one enjoy anything? Because it seems like no one enjoys anything anymore.
When I was, I keep turning this into a nostalgia fest, but still, in the old days, son, if you were a fan of something, you expressed it through fanzines. And that took a lot of effort. You had to actually make them yourselves and print them or even write letters to magazines.
And
doing that was such an effort that you only did it if you were enthusiastic. You didn't do it if you hated something. You just went, I'm not going to bother with that anymore.
I mean, I don't agree with it, but I respect all the people that wrote letters to Warner Brothers protesting when Michael Keaton was cast as Batman, voicing their outrage that Beetlejuice was doing it or that, you know, some bald-headed Englishman was going to be the captain of the Enterprise, because there's only one captain of the Enterprise. It's William Shatner and writing letters. I appreciate that effort. If you're going to stick to your guns, write a letter, fold it up, get a stamp, walk down the road, put it in the postbox. If you're going to go to that much effort, then you clearly care. But Jesus Christ. Social media.
It's definitely lowered the bar of effort for being a dick. Essentially. Okay, let's get back to baddies because otherwise fandom is the baddie.
Fandom is the ultimate baddie.
Yeah.
And it must be defeated at all costs.
Absolutely. who's the funniest baddie for you? Who's a baddie who's been most sort of makes you laugh the most?
That is a good question. That is a great question. I'm trying to think now because I remember reading an interview with Joss Whedon. This is back in the day.
Yeah.
And it was when he was making Serenity and he cast all these kind of comedians in dramatic roles. And he said, comedy is the hardest thing to get right in terms of timing and everything. If you're good at comedy, you're good at everything else. So that's why he casts lots of comedians in dramatic roles. And I'm trying to think of like an actor who is a comedian that has done a villainous role very well. And now I'm struggling. Someone like Christopher Lee, now that we mentioned him in Star Trek 3,
Christopher Lloyd,
you know, because of Taxi and Back to the Future and, you know, even showing up in Cheers as a, you know, a weird painter. He's very good at just kind of going from deranged to adorable. For some reason, that's one sticking in my mind. Michael Keaton is another one. He's got a film coming out called The Protégé that Martin Campbell's directed. He looks like he's the bad guy in that. Michael Keaton is a funny guy.
What about Robin Williams in One Shot Photo? That's... One shot photo, one...
I find him creepier in Insomnia.
Yes, yeah.
Because he's so, you know, it was all an accident. I didn't mean to kill this girl. You know, I really liked him. I find that creepier than just kind of like One Hour Photo where it's like, you're creepy. But it's kind of like in Insomnia where he's trying to justify what he's done and say, oh, you know, we really liked each other. And
And Pacino has that killer line where he says something like, it took you 3 hours to beat her to death. And it's just like, oops.
Is a good call. Robin Williams. Yeah, that is very unnerving when he plays a killer. Yeah.
But in that case, he's not being funny. Like he's a comedian who's playing against type. I was thinking...
I'm going to come back to Alan Rickman as the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yeah.
Because he is in his complete own film. Kevin Costner is in a completely different film. And Alan Rickman is just storming around the castle, you know, demanding statues be made of him, getting women sent to his room, cancelling Christmas. He's great. He elevates that film so much into what would otherwise, you know, just be a standard 90s, you know, sword-waving action thing with Alan Rickman there. And he's just there picking his teeth while, you know, the merry men are getting slaughtered. Yeah, Alan Rickman, I think.
Yeah.
That man was legit hilarious. Everything from like Galaxy Quest, and then just taking that kind of dryness and just putting it into the Sheriff of Nottingham.
I loved him in Bob Roberts as the sort of chief of staff of Tim Robbins' sort of right-wing, well, outright sort of congressman running for president. And he,
I don't think I've ever seen that. I have to look it up now.
There's a brilliant bit where he's shot. Bob Roberts is shot. It's not a spoiler. It happens sort of halfway through. It's not. It's a kind of faux documentary. So it's, and Rickman, who is this sort of prince of darkness in terms of his being his press agent and everything, sort of says he's giving an interview outside the hospital, and he says at the end, he says, "Excuse me, I've got to go and pray," and walks off. And you just think, this guy is so good, because he's the last person ever to pray. So it's just this sliminess is complete. I was also thinking of Dennis Hopper. I mean, obviously in Blue Velvet he's terrifying, but there's also a weird line of humor in that role. And then he turns up again in Waterworld, and he has this line where he talks about one tear rolling down my manly cheek at one point. And I don't know, he just seems to have a lot of fun even when he shouldn't.
I think that was after Speed, where they were like, oh, Speed was such a big hit, let's put Dennis Hopper in anything and let him do whatever he wants.
Yeah,
I think when you give an actor like that just free rein to do whatever they want, it's always good fun. Whether it matches the tone of the film or not is another matter altogether.
Well, as you say, yeah, it becomes sort of like a different film in those scenes. David Lynch had a brilliant story he tells in his autobiography about casting Dennis Hopper for Blue Velvet. Basically, Hopper went after the role and phoned him up and said, look, you've got to give me this role. I am Fat Frank Booth. And Lynch said, ah, Dennis, that's both really, really good news and really, really bad news. So it's
Actors who kind of say, I'm really like this psychopathic killer. It's like actors who go method. Do you realize they often only go method when they're playing psychopaths or horrible people? No one ever goes method when it comes to playing a nice person. Maybe Daniel Day-Lewis for Abraham Lincoln. Maybe he was going around like freeing people and
Gangs of New York. He was going around Rome picking fights.
Of course he was. You read about all these people going method. It's like, what are you playing? Oh, you're playing a gangster or a thug or a killer. Of course you're going method.
Yeah. You're playing somebody who cleans toilets.
Yeah. Are you going method on that one? Oh, no, you're not. What a shocker.
I'm getting the impression that you think that method acting is a self-indulgent scam.
I'm definitely from, the apocryphal tale of, Laurence Olivier on Marathon Man, talking to Dustin Hoffman, who's been up three nights to portray being tired. And Laurence Olivier just goes, have you tried acting? Just act.
There's a really good story John Boorman tells of Burt Reynolds on Deliverance. And they had this scene where he's supposed to go through these dangerous rapids. And they said, okay, bring the dummy on. We're going to send the dummy down and film it. And Reynolds was like in his most macho stuntman sort of persona. He's like, no, it'll be rubbish. I'll do it. So Boorman's like saying, look, we can't risk you.
Reynolds.
Like, yeah, and he's like, insists, no, I'm going to do it. So Burt Reynolds goes down these rapids, hits his back on the rock, damages his back, has to be helicoptered out to hospital, operation on his back. Boorman turns up 2 days later to see how he is, and he's stretched out, and he says, what was the shot like? What did it look like? He said, it looked like you were a dummy. After doing all that, he still looked like fake,
Yeah.
Okay. What about this? Is another thing I wanted, because I was talking to somebody recently about Nobody, the new Bob Odenkirk film, and I was kind of saying, it's all a lot of fun and everybody enjoyed it and everything, but it's kind of quite noxious as well in terms of its, the messages it has and everything. And I know there's a lot of resistance to people talking about the ideological impact of, of big action movie entertainment. But, who the baddies are is kind of a very big ideological decision. And so if we go back to as you were saying, if you go back to Star Wars and everybody's white and British and, okay, we can read them as the Nazis, even though, it flips a nationality to some degree.
I think the uniforms are a dead giveaway.
Yeah. The triumph of the will celebrations by the rebels led by a southern farm boy somewhat complicate matters, but I get you. So that's also a question I sort of wanted to ask you, is that this idea of, you know, is it going to be Eastern European mafia who are acceptable? Is it going to be Indians, American Indians, Native Americans in the B movies? Is it going to be Tariq Ali or someone in True Lies? You know, who are, or even what was it in Back to the Future? Was it sort of Middle East?
Syrians. No, Libyans. The Libyans.
Right.
In their VW van.
Yeah. And there's a really, really racist film with Jeff Goldblum where I can't remember the exact nationality, but it's Middle Eastern terrorists. And they're all played by the directors in brownface, essentially. Mm. It's like even Steven Spielberg is in there, I think, somewhere. So how do you feel about that? Are there sort of films that you find it difficult to like because the villain is coming from that? Or do you just write it off as that's that particular moment and it wouldn't be the same today? But
that's really good, because, you know, a lot of things are the product of their time, and I'm someone who's half Indian, so like at this point for half of my life post 9/11 and even before 9/11, if anyone shows up with brown skin, there'd be me and my brothers going, he's going to be a terrorist and he's probably going to be dead in whatever. There was this one season of 24, that's a big 24 fan grant, I think it was the fourth season, and Cal Penn, who is a very funny Indian actor, and I think he's even worked for the Obama administration, but before then he was playing a Muslim student in 24, and terrorists detonate a nuclear bomb in LA, and he is suddenly beaten up by two, you know, Johnny rednecks in the street of LA who are like, oh, you're a terrorist. How dare you do this to our country? And he's saved by this lovely white family who take him in. And then lo and behold, he's a terrorist and takes him hostage. And I was watching it going, what the fuck kind of message is this? So yeah, I'm very conscious of, you know, when something is made and what message it does send out. And I think Middle Eastern terrorists, you know, whether it's Executive Decision or True Lies, you know, they are a trope that Hollywood does go back to the well with very often. However, today, what I've noticed is the terrorists seem to be people who seem to be inherently anti-capitalism and trying to tear down this old world to rebuild a new one. Most recently in Falcon and the Winter Soldier, where the flag smashers were, you know, people who had survived the blip or the snap in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where countries had all kind of come together to survive half the population getting erased. And they were dedicated to feeding people. And then somewhere along the lines, yeah, the filmmakers were like, well, we can't make them too sympathetic. Let's make them burn these aid workers to death or something. And I was like, this is very odd. And also environmental terrorists, people who are like environmentalists. And I remember reading Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six book back in the day. I think that was early 2000s. And the people in that are people who want to stop overpopulation. I think they're going to release a virus to kill people because they want to save the planet. And, you know, even Thanos in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is someone who, you know, is basically resources are running out. He wants to be completely clean about it and just remove half of everyone, when really he should just kind of maybe get rid of the people that seem to be using up all the resources or create more resources. There are so many ways he could have done.
Or you're in a universe. I mean, it's kind of infinite.
Yeah, but it's very interesting who Hollywood is making villains these days. The Russian mafia seem to be a go-to one, but like the John Wick and Nobody, and even in Black Widow, it's always, you know, side. It's never the Russian government. It's always, oh, they're a Russian black ops side unit thing that's separate. Russians seem to be infinitely villainous. I think the Middle Eastern trope may have been worn out now, finally, after God knows how many decades. Interestingly, China isn't that big a go-to villain because these films often have to play abroad.
Well, they famously flipped Red Dawn, the remake of Red Dawn. They flipped from China to North Korea
and digitally changed all the flags. Yeah, and even... Yeah, it's very odd. I think North Korea was... No one takes North Korea that seriously as a threat in movies? Because it's like, what are they going to do? Except maybe in Olympus Has Fallen, where suddenly they take the White House. Yeah, I think these days it's always kind of the big multinational industrial military complex types, your Blackwater types, people who just seem to have armies of mercenaries. And I think that is the most interesting villain, because these days you do have lots of mercenary groups doing America's bidding around the world, or private contractors, or people like that. I would like to see kind of more Rupert Murdoch, Mark Zuckerberg types be portrayed as villains. I think the Bond film Tomorrow Never Dies was ahead of its time in having a Rupert Murdoch film, you know, type person trying to orchestrate a war in order to sell newspapers. Maybe that bit hasn't aged that well, but the rest of it, to get broadcast rights in China or whatever it is. But, you know, in terms of manipulating information and everything to kind of move political events, I think those are the most interesting ones. Multinationals with mercenary arms, I think, is where I've settled.
Are there any, would there be any films that sort of like you find difficult to watch because of the sort of the group which is targeted, or is it, are you able to sort of take it with a pinch of salt and just consider the context and not?
I never was really into John Wayne films because it's always the Native Americans that are the bad guys. I like the Westerns where it's like bandits or Confederate raiders, or it's, you know, Yankee raiders and, you know, the spaghetti Westerns.
I was going to say the Sergio Leone films American Indians don't even, Native Americans don't even turn up, you know.
Exactly. And same with stuff like The Magnificent Seven or The Wild Bunch. It's always kind of like warlords. But, you know, where it's Westerns, where it's like, we've got a bunch of Puerto Rican and Mexican actors and we're going to say they're Native Americans. Those ones never really sit well. I think those are probably the only ones. I'm more fascinated by when Hollywood finds like a trope and makes about five films, becomes fascinated and makes five films around it, like the Yakuza. It's like, oh, we're going to make Black Rain, Showdown in Little Tokyo, Crime Freeman. And there's like, for 5 years, it's like, we're going to make films about the Yakuza or Haitian warlords doing drugs in New York, like they show up in Predator 2. And it's like, I like those quirky things. It's like, oh, we can do it on the triads and stuff like that. Something exotic, or, you know, white supremacist Ku Klux Klan on the rise things, where it's just kind of like a broad swath of it's Native Americans or it's Muslims. It's like they are the least interesting type of films to me. Yeah. So like Die Hard, where it's like they're not terrorists aligned to any political leaning. They're just bank robbers. They're just robbers. They're thieves. That's it. That's more interesting. That's much more interesting.
More complicated, and yet at the same time, it's multi-layered. You know, he's actually playing with our own fears in order to distract us. You know, the Alan Rickman, Hans Gruber in that. What about, is there going to be a third volume? Are there some people that you'd really love to get that you haven't been able to get yet?
That's why I did the second volume, to kind of get people that I didn't get the first time. And while I got a whole bunch the second time around, there are still a few that I wasn't able to get, but I don't think it's enough names to justify a third volume. So I think I'm tapped out now. Yeah, in terms of like writing another book, I've got a few ideas.
Uh-huh.
I was working on one, but I've kind of shelved it for now.
Uh-huh.
It was all about kind of interviewing people who were there on notoriously, famously difficult productions.
Right.
So I'd spoken to Jason Fleming about what really happened on The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen? Did Stephen Norrington and Sean Connery get into a fight? And, you know, Lance Guest on Jaws the Revenge, but it's all kind of like, I don't know how to put that book together. And there are films that I definitely want to cover, and no one from that was involved in it wants to talk about it.
Yeah, I've had this idea for ages, and I've even floated it on Twitter, that there's a Netflix documentary to be made about the Twilight Zone movie. You know, because it's just such a fascinating story, and it's just, but at the same time, you know, it's would be so frightening from a legal point of view that you just wouldn't get in there.
So many big names are attached to that film that have no interest in such a project coming out.
Absolutely. But if you're listening,
dear Mr. Spielberg, it was just an idea. We're not serious.
Yeah. No, that's great. So what would be your, that sounds like a really good idea. I'd really like that. And I've just finished reading Mark Harris's book, Scenes from the Revolution.
Oh, yeah.
he talks about the Dr. Doolittle, you know, which has
this production history. Was that 1970, 1971, the year Hollywood kind of went independent? So
no, it's earlier, it's 68. I mean, it's the 68 Oscars. They might have come out in 67, but it's the 68 Oscars. And so it's Dr. Doolittle, In the Heat of the Night, The Graduate, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and Bonnie and Clyde.
And then when did Easy Rider come out? Was that 70? So it's kind of like studios are still banking on stuff like Dr. Doolittle, and then films like Easy Rider are taking
over. Yeah, I get a feeling Easy Rider's 69. I think it's just under the wire of the 60s.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, we always look at these difficult productions like Days of Heaven, and we think of these big, difficult productions as sort of the result of the new Hollywood running wild. Whereas, you know, I mean, Dr. Doolittle was absolutely a nightmare, completely over budget, completely over schedule, with a drunk, intoxicated lead man who was self-sabotaging everything in sight.
I grew up watching that film, and I knew nothing about the behind-the-scenes trouble because my mum was a big musical fan. So I grew up watching so many musicals, like all the Rodgers and Hammersteins. I think the first film I remember watching was Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. So Dr. Doolittle was a one that was played a lot in the house as during my childhood. I had no idea about the behind-the-scenes strife until probably a couple of years ago, where I was like really reading into it. I was like, Jesus Christ, what was going on?
Harrison was this like a avuncular, twinkly-eyed guy. You know, it wasn't like you didn't look at him and think there's somebody who's going to punch you in the face and get drunk.
No, exactly. You grow up watching him stuff like My Fair Lady, and then, you know, you suddenly talk to people and go, oh, you know, he's a complete dick. I'm like, yeah. Rex Harrison, really?
Sexy Rexy?
Yeah, it's like he was the worst. Yeah, you know, I can't believe it. Okay.
Absolutely. Okay, what's your film book recommendation? What film book would you like to recommend to our listeners?
Well, I mean, you've already had, blanking on his name now, sorry that you had him on, but I do love Tales from Development Hell and, you know,
greatest. Oh, David Hughes.
David Hughes, sorry. Former Empire writer David Hughes. I've got both his books. I love films that were never made. But as a big action film fan, I'm going to recommend Mike Fury's Life of Action. Right. So Mike Fury is a stuntman, stunt coordinator, and his first book, Life of Action, was a very big influence on my book, Born to be Bad, because he basically tracked down a lot of stuntmen, stunt coordinators, people that have worked behind the scenes in action films and talked to them about their process. And that's everyone from like legendary stuntman Vic Armstrong to Scarlett Johansson's stunt double, Heidi Moneymaker. So it's all about how they kind of get into stunts, what goes into making, you know, the biggest names in Hollywood look as good as they do. Oh, and you know, while you're at it, pick up Vic Armstrong's autobiography, because that's amazing.
It's amazing. I love
that's a great book.
Yeah,
how he met his wife. She was doubling Margot Kidder and he was doubling Christopher Reeve. That scene where Superman catches her, that's how he met his wife. It's like, that's amazing. That is a story for the ages.
The best story in that book is when he's invited by Harrison Ford to meet up while he's in America. So he goes over to his house and it's sort of quite in the distance. It's quite isolated is the word I'm looking for. Anyway, he finds it and he goes in and Harrison Ford says, oh, I want to, he's sort of a bit surprised that it's only him. It's like, oh, we just the two of us then. And he's like, yeah, why not? And he says, oh, but first I want to show you something in the bedroom. And Vic Armstrong's like, okay. And he goes into the bedroom and Harrison Ford wants to show him the chest of drawers he's just made. And he pulls the drawer out and he says, look at the dovetailing on the on the joint there. And Vic Armstrong's kind of like relieved and slightly disappointed at the same time, I think.
I love that about Harrison Ford. The fact that he was a carpenter before he was an action star and to this day he's just making stuff is great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the name of the book that you're recommending.
So Mike Fury is by Mike Fury and there's Life of Action, Volume 1 and Volume 2. And it's interviews with some of the biggest names in action films, including like many of the guys from 87-11. I think Donnie Yen's in there as well. Scott Adkins is in the first one. Zoe Bell, who doubled Uma Thurman, the Kill Bill films.
And appears in Death Proof as well as herself.
And also in The Hateful Eight. As well. So if you're into action films and especially stunts, the Life of Action books are great. And yeah, Mike knows his stuff. He's also on Twitter, the Mike Fury. So that and Vic Armstrong's book. If you're just into kind of stunts and behind the scenes of like action films, I think those books are essential. I think they're just really interesting.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Well, listen, Ty, thanks so much for talking to me and for giving me your time. Congratulations on the book. Volume 2 is highly recommended, and I'm going to go and get Volume 1 now, and so I can read all about all the people I missed.
Oh, Ronnie Cox from Deliverance is in the first one. So he's got some good Deliverance stories. And I met Ronnie on the back of the first book coming out. I was hired as a writer-producer on the documentary In Search of the Last Action Heroes. So I got to go to LA and interview a whole bunch of the people I had previously interviewed for the first book in person. So people like Bill Duke and Ronnie Cox and Stephen D'Souza, who wrote the intro for the first book and obviously wrote films like The Running Man and Commando and Die Hard. So yeah, it's there's some great stories in the first one. And if you don't like Steven Seagal, prepare to have those beliefs solidified.
Absolutely. Brilliant. Thanks so much, Ty.
No problem. Thank you, John.
So that was our conversation, me and Ty. I hope you enjoyed it. His recommended book was Mike Fury's Life in Action, Volumes 1 and 2. He also recommended Vic Armstrong's autobiography, which I can highly recommend as well. It's a brilliant book. Thanks as ever go to Elliot Atkins for the music and Ali Harwood for the art. Until next episode, please take care.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.